My name is Ian O'Neill, and this is How They Did It, a podcast where we learn filmmaking from those who've gone before us. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to How They Did It, a podcast for indie filmmakers, especially those just starting out looking to make their very first film, although anyone at any level can listen and learn. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle TV, the world's first streaming service dedicated to filmmakers, screenwriters, and content creators. You'll find content on every step of filmmaking, from screenwriting and producing to crowdfunding and distribution. It's Netflix for filmmakers. Sign up today at ifhtv.com. I had the absolute pleasure of conversing with Carter Ferguson, who is a really interesting guy and is someone with an abundance of experience. In fact, he has over 700 TV and movie credits to his name. He's a fight director, a writer, a producer, a podcaster, among other things. The man has so much knowledge to share. So, without further ado, here's the interview. Carter Ferguson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, I'm absolutely pleased to have you here. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time. Do us all a favor, introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a Scotland-based fight director. I direct action fight sequences in film and television here in Scotland mostly, although occasionally I get out and about. And I'm also a filmmaker, and I'm also the host of a podcast, which I launched maybe, 6 weeks ago, something like that, which is Film Pro Productivity.
Excellent. So you mentioned fight directing. How and when did you get involved in fight directing?
Well, I kind of got lucky. I trained at Queen Margaret College in Edinburgh, and the guy that was teaching us stage combat there, I trained as an actor. The guy that was teaching us stage combat was called Bert Bracewell. And it just so happened that he was not only the Olympic fencing coach and had been for 21 years, but he'd also been one of the founder members of the Society of British Fight Directors. So we just happened to have like one of the best fight guys in Scotland, possibly the world, teaching us. And he was reaching retirement age. So even before I left college, he'd got me out of college directing fight sequences at Pitlochry Festival Theatre. And I also directed fight sequences in the college itself.
Wow. What a fortunate little thing to happen.
Absolutely.
Holy mackerel. You just seamlessly went right into it. That's fantastic.
Well, there's thousands and thousands of young actors coming out at any one year. But there's not thousands and thousands of fight directors with a teacher that good.
Yeah. Well, and I have to say, it shows in your work, believe me. I've seen some of your work, and oh man, is it good.
Thanks very much.
You know what? What made you want to make your own films? Because you've made quite a few short films and a feature film as well. So what made you jump into making your own films?
It's kind of connected to the fight stuff. I had been directing theatre shows with Scottish Youth Theatre, and I'd also been the assistant director at the Citizens Theatre in Glasgow on a few shows. So I had experience of actually directing rather than just doing fights, although it was fights that opened up the opportunity for me to direct, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But I decided to start shooting my own films really because I knew that somewhere down the line I was not going to be physically capable of doing the fight sequences, if that makes sense. That somewhere down the line, you know, I'm going in every day and rolling about in the ground and fighting actors. And, you know, at some point, surely I'm going to be really feeling it. I'm kind of feeling it now. I'm 46. And what I imagined kind of 10 years ago, which is when I started doing short films and stuff like that, is that maybe I could make a transition from fight director to director in TV and film. That was my thoughts.
Yeah. Are you any closer to that, you think?
Good question. No, I don't think so.
Good answer.
I've won a load of awards. To be honest, the fight stuff has really opened up, especially this year. It's gone crazy this year. But I don't know what to say about this. There aren't really opportunities for me to move into that area. I can do my own stuff, and if I do my own stuff, I've got control of it, and I can create good stuff. But there's not like a line of people there asking me to direct their projects or to direct TV shows or whatever.
Yeah,
I'm kind of getting there actually, in a sense, because the short film Dead End, which we made in China a couple of years ago.
Oh, such a good
film. Really a couple of years ago. We kind of finished it last year. It took about a year to complete it.
Yeah.
But that's won like 30 plus awards at film festivals now, and it's opened up doors in China. No doors are opening up in Scotland or in the UK, but in China I'm attached to two feature films which are in development. One's got a Beijing producer attached and he's putting money into it, and the other one has got a Spanish producer involved in it, and they're moving forwards.
And you're attached as director?
I'm attached as director on one and co-director on the other.
Fantastic.
But you and I both know, Ian, that both of these projects could collapse at any minute.
At any second. But be positive. Be positive. Yes. It's not going to. That's fantastic. Now, you mentioned you mentioned Dead End, and you produced and directed it, and it is, I've seen it. It's fantastic, and yes, it's multi-award winning, and it should be. It's a great short film. It is just an amazing short film. Can you give us a short description of it?
Do you want the plot kind of thing?
Sure.
Or how it all came about?
Well, first the plot, and then we'll get into how it came about.
It's about a hitman who's asked to return to Hong Kong and do a job, but there's a reason he's not returned to Hong Kong, and that was that he'd had a bit of a problem there the last time he'd been there, and he's not really keen on going back, but he goes back to do a job, and it, of course, being drama, doesn't go quite according to plan.
No, it does not.
No.
But it's beautifully shot. So, you know, now, how did it come about?
Well, quite an unusual situation came about. I work with a friend of mine, Brian Larkin. He's my friend, but he's also my colleague. And we are very, very tight collaborators on the films that we've made. We've made two other short films before that, which are kind of Dead End was part three of a Dead series, because we shot two on 48-hour film projects, which were Dead Ringer and then Dead Drop. And they did really, really well. Embarrassingly, at one of these 48-hour projects, we won 5 of the 20 awards just on our film. And in the second one, we won 3 awards on when we did that. And those awards were, I think, Best Cinematographer, Best Director and Best Editor. So they were really kind of good awards. And really, Brian and I work quite tightly together and well together. There's not really an ego there.
Yeah.
So anyway, Brian's actually an actor and a very good one. He's been in some big action movies like London Has Fallen, etc. And I was approached by a film company in London to suggest some action actors for a feature film they were shooting. And I suggested, amongst others, Brian Larkin.
Oh.
And so Brian ended up, he auditioned and he got the job on this kind of low budget. I don't know what the budget was. I'm guessing maybe £300,000 to £500,000, somewhere around there. It's called Vengeance, and actually that was released maybe a month ago, directed by Ross Boask. But when he was on that, I believe the connection was the director, Ross, spoke to a producer in Hong Kong who was looking to cast a villain in a Donnie Yen action movie called Chasing the Dragon. And Brian, who's really dedicated and an excellent actor, he ended up in Hong Kong as a result of this low-budget movie he did in London. And Brian, being Brian, invited me over onto the China movie. So before I knew it, I was standing in China working on an action movie with Donnie Yen in front of me directing fight sequences. It was like a dream come true. I couldn't believe what was happening. It's just because Brian blagged me onto it.
Oh, man.
So while we were there, I've probably gone off on a tangent. I'm sorry if I'm making any sense.
No, go.
But basically, Brian wasn't required every single day on that shoot. And we both had Canon 60Ds, which are not a particularly high-end camera, but give a really nice quality. And we decided to shoot something. Brian already had an idea. He'd been working with an actor out there called Julian Gertner, I think is how you would pronounce it, or Gartner, German actor. And he'd met a photographer out there called Thomas Sandfield. So he had a couple of guys that could speak the lingo who were willing to come in on the film. And Brian had a fairly clear idea of what he wanted to do. And Dead End really was shot on the offers of this larger action movie, this Donnie Yen movie. Wow. And we kind of put it together, and it was kind of okay. To some extent, when we initially shot it, it was maybe stereotypical thriller. But what happened is we returned after the main shoot to the UK, and Brian cut a trailer for it. Brian, who doesn't like people to know this, but Brian's an amazing editor. He's an amazing editor. And he cut a trailer for it, which was just amazing. You know, we had the footage and stuff. We'd done a couple of days but then in the UK as well. I can't remember how it all worked out. But that trailer caught the eye of Black Camel Pictures, who we'd worked with before as well. Black Camel had shot three Nazi zombie movies.
Wow.
Subgenre Nazi zombie, called Outpost. And in the third one of them, I was second unit director and I was fight director on it, and I had got Brian cast in that. So we had a good, tight relationship with Black Camel, and Black Camel liked it so much that they gave us a little bit of money to go back out, do a few pickups and pay for things like music and a sound mix.
Wow. So,
and then by the end of that, we had Dead End.
Wow. Holy mackerel. What a trip.
It was... I mean, we kept on thinking there was something going on. Even when Black Camel were offering us money, we're like, what do they want? why do they want our film? And it was just they wanted to be involved. They thought it was a good
movie. Because
good
it's movie. A great film. It really is. Well, you know what? And this brings me to a question about casting, because there were locals cast in this film as well, true?
Yes.
So how did you go about that casting process?
We had to lean heavily on our contacts on the ground there. So Julian is based in Hong Kong, the German actor Julian. He's based there. Thomas is based there. And we had a producer who'd also done some of the casting on Chasing the Dragon, Mike Leader, and he was involved as well. And so using the contacts really that Brian had made there before I arrived, because he was shooting there before I even got there, we just started putting it together and trying to find the right people. And... there was a little bit more casting before we returned to do some pickups, which was once we'd got the money from Black Camel, which, as I say, that just gave us a little bit of room to shoot some pickups and improve the film generally. But that said, Brian and I had shot some more stuff in London, which was cut into it, and we discovered a few things in the edit. I think Brian did one cut of it. I'm sorry if I'm going off on a tangent for this.
He did one cut.
Something interesting happened while he was playing around with the footage we had, which was all written scenes and stuff, and it was working the way we thought it was going to work. But Brian added a gag to a scene, which was basically a one-liner. And suddenly this film, which had kind of been almost like a Bourne-like copy, jumped in level and became... an accessible action movie that was ours, because the slight bit of humour, like what happens in Die Hard, just lifted it out of that sort of grainy copy of something else and made it a bit more our own.
Yeah, absolutely.
So kind of we organically found this film, although we went out there with the intention to shoot what we shot, we found other things along the way.
Wow. But what a happy accident. For all these things to come together. Wow. So when it came to crew, though, you said you had a few people that were integral to the film. Did you sort of cherry pick from the other film that you were working on to use crew?
Not really. Not really. I think, Mike was involved in it and Julian was involved in it. But I'm not entirely sure how Thomas came into it. Thomas basically became the lead DOP, the lead cinematographer on it. But I don't think he was associated with the main movie. I think what Brian seemed to do before I got there was make contacts with a whole load of kind of mid-level filmmakers that are based in Hong Kong and connected with them and was able to draw a couple into what we were doing, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. He was the feet on the ground before you got there, yeah. And he's making things happen before you even get there. Absolutely. Yeah. Pardon me. So you had multi roles. Did you take on multi roles of directing and fight directing in this one?
Yeah, I did.
That would have been a lot of work.
Well, actually, not many people have seen the film. It's been in film festivals, but it's not been released. You have.
I got to see it.
And it's definitely known as an action thriller, but there's not that much actual fight action in it. There's the lift scene.
That was
which
tough.
Is set in London.
That was that in London?
That was set in London. And there's actually one scene in the movie that's was shot in Scotland cuts in that you can't quite tell, hopefully.
No, but I couldn't tell at all. I couldn't tell the elevator scene was in London.
Well, the elevator scene was shot with GoPros, and I was in the elevator with them when I could, with physically holding the GoPro against the wall.
So
you know what it's like.
That's GoPro's three people in a lift, in an elevator, and you're fighting.
Yeah.
Holy mackerel.
Well, you know, it was one of those things. They were great actors, though. Mark Griffin was the one that was fighting Brian in the lift at that point. The more difficult thing for them was that I couldn't always be in the lift. Sometimes I had to, I think we stuck the GoPro to the ceiling for one shot with blue tack, something like that, and it was on the floor for one shot. But there was no one in the lift at that point. We couldn't control the lift because it was shot guerrilla style. And so they were going up and down a lift in London, and it was literally little old women were hitting the lift button, opening it up, and these two guys are fighting in there and apologizing, of course. Being very polite,
sorry, but we're bleeding on the lift. I'm really sorry.
Yeah, I don't think we had any blood, to be fair, but we did have a gun in there, which is maybe a little bit iffy. Well, did we have a gun in there? I'm not sure.
You did have a gun in there because he puts the gun to the back of his head, remember?
That's right. But that was an open door, so that I'm thinking
the gun might have disappeared
in the
by then.
Up and down.
Oh,
you know, with the gun, when it hits the floor, it actually hits the floor in Scotland. Because we had to fake the drop gun because we shot the fight scene. And you know what it's like, these crazy movies we shoot. Brian, when he cut it together, is like, "Oh, Carter, we need this. We need the gun hitting the ground." It just disappears, and I'm like, "We don't need it. We don't need it." And Brian, being Brian, tormented me till I actually had to go out and shoot this cutaway of a gun hitting the lift. So yeah, they drop the gun in London, and it hits the floor in Glasgow.
Well, that's the way it happens, right? You have to pick up where you can pick up.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I don't think they were ever traveling up and down in the lift with a gun. I don't think I would have allowed that to happen.
That is... Well, the fact that they're scrapping and they're fighting and people are opening the door, these little women are seeing these two guys in a tussle. That's priceless. I'm sorry, but that's priceless. And that's guerrilla filmmaking. I mean, you don't have a permit, you don't have a key to operate the lift, and you just got to do what you got to do.
Exactly. Oh. We'd kind of been told we had permission to shoot in that lift.
Yeah.
And then when we got there, we realized we didn't have permission to shoot in the lift. But to be honest, Ian, that could be said for virtually every location in the film.
Really?
When we went back out and shot some pickups in Hong Kong, Brian was shooting pickups on the other movie. It was shooting pickups at the same time, so he was going out there anyway. We timed our pickups to be when Brian was going to be back there.
Right.
But I spent a day locking down locations in Hong Kong with Thomas, the DOP.
Yeah.
And so we locked down a roof location, and we locked down an interior location on that same roof, and we locked down a location in a park, which we were led to believe was a public park. But when we came to shoot, the interior scene... They apparently didn't know we were coming, even though we'd spoken to them the day before. We had to move that into another location on the lift, and we had to, not on the lift, on the roof.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of funny story behind that, because there was a guy dotting about, basically causing trouble. So we had to kind of bribe him to stay in this location. You know the torture scene at the start, and it's there's a guy in a chair.
Yeah.
that was on the roof, but that wasn't the location we went to. That was just another space. This guy was dotting about with his shirt off. I was bribing him, and what I found out later is Brian was also bribing him, which is the problem with bribes. You can't tell they're off book. So he was playing both of us. So we shot that. Then we went onto the roof, another locked location, and we found out that we had to be off the roof in 2 hours, and we were going to shoot a scene that was going to be like 4.5-5 hour scene,
wow,
which was the final scene of the whole movie. It's a big scene.
It's penultimate. And,
yeah, so we were then told you can stay till 10, and it was like 8:30 or something like this. So we were like, we can't shoot it in this amount of time, and so we ended up moving that. But we went down to the park to shoot the other scene, and then a cop turns out, and it turns out it wasn't a public park; it was next to a government building. It was a government park, and we were told to get out there as well. So, an interesting series of events.
Holy cow, that's insane! They're chasing you all over Hong Kong.
Yeah, it wasn't easy, but then it's kind of part of the, I'm going to use the word fun here, but you know it wasn't that much fun in the night.
Well, at the time it wasn't, but you can laugh about it now, right? It's done, and it's just an experience, and you have to experience it. There's one thing I want to talk about before we move on to something else. You mentioned that you shot this with 60Ds, so Canon 60D, and a GoPro. I know you used some drones.
Yeah.
Was there any other camera that you used?
Yeah, we used Samsung S7 phones.
And you used phones?
Yeah. The slow-mo footage is, some of it is on the on Brian's S7.
Right.
Using an Osmo mobile, I think.
Okay.
Which was a nice combination, although when it shoots slow-mo, it shoots in 720, so we had to upscale that.
Right, right.
And so there's a little bit of moire on the 1080. Yeah. When you see it, it's one of those things where you see it on a massive screen, you spot things that you would have liked to have not happened. But it's fine. You know, we had zero budget on this, you know, so other than the money that came in at the back end to help us complete, it was shot on nothing. So, but I believe that some of it was shot in the 60D at a higher frame rate, and other stuff was shot on Samsung S7s.
Well, and the reason I'm talking about this is because so many people who are thinking about doing a film, whether it's a short film, feature film, whatever it is, a web series, whatever, they always stop themselves because they think they don't have the right gear.
Yeah.
And you guys took what cameras you had and made a phenomenal short film. So listen, people, take whatever you've got, whatever camera you, I don't care if it's your cell phone or if it's a low-end camera or you think it's a low-end camera, make your movie. Go out there and make your movie. Do what Carter did. Go out there and make your movie.
You don't have to spend a fortune these days. The prices have come right down.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly the phone qualities are just outstanding. A friend of mine shot a corporate the other day on an iPhone 7. And I couldn't tell it was shot on anything other than a great camera. It looked amazing.
Because now you can get apps that give you more control over what you're shooting as well.
Like Filmic Pro.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
but then the things like the 60D, if you don't want to spend a little bit of money, you don't have to have a GH5S, you don't have to have the Blackmagic 4K pocket cinema camera that's just come out. In fact, the older version, the 1080p version, this is the time to buy it because people are punting them onto eBay and selling them cheap.
That's true.
You can get them with a ton of batteries and stuff and with a speed booster probably for, you know, $500, $600.
That's true, you know. But here's the issue with that. Now, if you're starting out and everything's fine, but if you're shooting for corporate, your clients sometimes they want 4K. So for me, I have to get a new camera because that's the situation. The camera that I have isn't 4K. I have to get 4K. But if you're for film, I'll use anything that I've got. I've got an array of cameras that I'll just, as long as it shoots decent quality, I'll take it. I've got an 8-year-old Panasonic that's a giant camera that is it's recognizable though. People know you're shooting something when you have this camera.
Yeah.
The great thing about your 60Ds is you could probably hide them a little bit as you were shooting, and you look more like a tourist than you do like a filmmaker.
Oh, absolutely. Although we can be conspicuous in some of the action we're shooting.
Exactly.
The 60D has got the flip out screen, and you know it shoots 1080p, the Canon feel, I mean, I've got a GH4 now, but the feel of the 60D, I shot something the other day there and I didn't pick up the GH4. I took
really?
Out the 60D and I shot with that using not even new lenses. My favorite lens is a Super Takumar 50mm 1.4. It's an M42 lens.
Wow.
You can pick that up for about 100 quid, maybe $100 or so. You can get them a little bit cheaper as well. But the amazing quality and depth of field and warmth you get from lenses like that, these older lenses, is incredible. But funnily enough, I went along there with the 60D and I picked up the 18-35 constant 1.8 Sigma.
Ooh.
Am I boring, by the way?
This is very good. I like hearing about this kind of stuff, and I'm sure people out there are going to wonder what you shoot and how you shoot. And again, it's not, you're not picking up like the top of the line Sony lenses, and like this is fantastic because you're doing what you can with what you have, and you're adding to it so you can get better quality. It's wonderful.
That lens, that Sigma lens, it's a great lens. It's a beautiful lens. Very, very clean. But I shot a little bit with that, and then I moved on to this older lens. You know, it's a $100 lens, 100 quid lens. And that's what I shot the rest of the music video on, was just that lens. As soon as I put it on, I was like, why did I bother with other lenses? This is incredible.
Speaking of the lenses.
Sorry, that's the radioactive lens, incidentally. That's the one that's got a radioactive element within it.
Oh, really?
So I've not had it taken off me at airports yet, but I expect one day for it to be removed.
Be careful. Put it in a lead-lined case when you put it through.
Yeah, that'll help with my baggage. Yeah.
You know what? So you shot with so many cameras, but did you shoot with a lot of cinematographers?
Yes.
You did.
But not intentionally. And not because we fell out either. That was not the reason. The lead cinematographer was Thomas Sandfield in Hong Kong. So, and he actually had a 5D Mark III, I believe. So there was another camera in there I didn't mention earlier. But Thomas was doing other corporate things at the time. And we had another DOP covered for a day and a half or a night and a half called Arne Venema. And he shot the opening roof scene. And he shot some of the party, street party stuff in Lan Kwai Fong. That was a real place with real stuff happening. And we were just going in and out of it. And also in Hong Kong, Brian and I shot quite a lot. I shot way more on this film than probably I've done on other films. And normally I'm quite happy to let a cinematographer shoot. But again, just the way it worked out, it was easy for me to pick up a second camera. If we're shooting it with one camera, I'll roll a second one if I could. And the actors were good enough once they were up to speed that I didn't have to constantly jump in and, you know, feed them notes and stuff like that, although I tried to remember along the way if there was a problem.
Yeah.
And as I say, Brian shot some stuff as well. In fact, there's a shot from a recce in the movie, which is a cutaway of a rat in a cage.
Yeah.
Which Brian shot that before I'd even got there. He'd went and recce'd with Julian and got this crazy shot of a real rat in a real cage. And as we... later on in the film, as he walks through a back alley, he's got a little look to the side and he just dropped in that shot of the rat, and that just adds another kind of level of value to the film, to this world. Then in London, we shot some stuff, and that was Keir Stewart, who was the director of photography in London. I believe he shot with a 5D Mark III. Wow. And it was in London, as I say, as well, that we shot with the GoPro. And then Brian, we'd kind of completed the film and Brian was in LA doing something else. And he met up with a friend of ours who'd been in one of the Black Camel Outpost movies. And Brian got another cinematographer who I never met, but I've got his name here, Istvan Varady. And he shot the LA scene, the very last scene in the film.
How did you keep track? So much.
We didn't do it all in a one-er, you know. We just added it a little bit. It was a sum of its parts, I think, is what I'm saying. That's how we kept track of it. We kind of knew what we had. And it was a short. It wasn't like a feature where we might have got lost in the story somewhere. If something was getting shot, it was getting shot because we knew it would add something to the film or to the story or to the feel of it.
Now, you've already mentioned the funding of the film. Did you guys put in... You guys must have put in cash yourselves.
I got out there the first time for something like, I think it was £300 I spent to get there to Hong Kong and back, because I had a connection with British Airways, so I got a deal. So and then when we were there, we were staying either in the hotel that the big movie had paid for, or actually laterally at Julian's place, which he lives in an island just not far from Hong Kong. I mean, we were spending money in the sense of on the food and on our travel,
right?
But we were shooting with what we had. Perfect. And I think we bought a GoPro mount twice. One of those situations where we went to this massive market and bought a GoPro mount, and then somewhere along the line it went missing, so we had to go back and buy it again. And that was for the motorbike stuff. Because in Hong Kong as well, Julian had a GoPro, and we mounted that on the motorbike. Oh, so motorbike stuff's all GoPro. Yeah, and when in London, I paid my own train fare down to London and back, but right. You know, not a lot.
Right,
it wasn't a lot, and the money that came in at the back end, half of it went into the sound mix, which I'll explain in a minute,
which is very important.
And the rest of it went into things we don't normally spend on. A little bit went into my travel to go back to Hong Kong for the pickups, which was £300 again.
Right.
Again, I got the deal through British Airways to get out there and back for £300. There was nothing, you know, really.
That's a damn good price.
Great. We stayed with Julian shooting that one. I did anyway. I think Brian was staying in a hotel somewhere in Hong Kong. I can't remember.
Wow.
Yeah, and the rest of the money went into music rights for the festival use, and we bought some drone stuff. So that
you bought that drone stuff?
We bought some of the drone stuff.
Yeah.
Thomas Sanfield, the DOP, the main DOP in Hong Kong, he shot a lot of the daytime Hong Kong stuff.
Yeah.
But either he wasn't confident or he wasn't willing to take the risk of losing
his drone at night.
His camera, his drone.
Yeah,
at night. I think he would, you know, worried about battering it into a building or killing somebody with it was probably what was on his mind.
Probably.
So we bought the nighttime Hong Kong footage and.
Wow.
We bought the London drone footage.
There you go. So what
about
sound? I've
never done that before, but you know, we don't have to shoot every single frame of our films ourselves, especially if they're time-consuming, expensive, and difficult like that.
Yeah, yeah. Now you talked about sound. There was some sound issues. Oh, with you laughing, I imagine it was sound issues.
I've listened to all of your episodes. I know you've got the same hang up I've got about sound, and it does have to be great. No, we when we shot in Hong Kong, we had this crazy brilliant idea that we were going to do it in what we were calling the Hong Kong style, because we'd been on this big movie and they weren't recording sound, or if they were, we couldn't tell. We never saw it. I mean, I'm sure there was a microphone somewhere, but basically it seemed to us they planned to do it in post production to add every single element as an ADR and
really
at the end. That's my belief. I might be completely wrong, because having
looped
tried
the whole
ourselves
thing. Wow.
It wasn't the best idea we've ever had. So we got vague and vague guide track while we shot. And then we'd always planned to do the mix as a sound mix with ADR, with additional dialogue recording, when I know we've spoken about this on your show before. But what we didn't realise when we did it that way is that when you edit with just this fairly appalling guide track, there's no satisfaction from what, even if you plan to re-record every bit of sound, when you're editing and you get terrible sound over a scene, you do not get the feel of the scene.
True.
If that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely.
And so we should have got better guide track, even if we had planned not to use it. And we kind of just went, we've got enough worries, that's put sound to the side. We know we're going to do it in post in the, in brackets, Hong Kong style. but yeah, this dissatisfaction is bad. And also, if you're going to do ADR, you need good guide track in order to let the actors sync to what they did before.
That's so true.
Not the best decision we've ever made.
Well, I have to say, since I've seen the film, I mean, the sounds, it was great.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
It is. It's. I don't know how you did it. If that was such a problem, you fixed it. It was fantastic. It was wonderful sound.
It was, and we've won a few awards for best sound and
Hong Kong style.
But the thing is, it did work exactly how we planned to. We just didn't do it very well.
Right.
You know, you kind of got to make your mistake in order to know, right, I wouldn't do it that way next time.
Right.
So we're going to shoot something else in the Hong Kong style, but we're going to get awesome guide track,
yeah,
which we will not probably use in the mix. We will still re-record every single actor's
voice.
Yeah,
but then you can sync up later, and if you've got better audio to use that with, it makes it easier in the end.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact,
I've just remembered, we did use one piece of audio from the ground, as it were, which was one line in the lift. I thought you'd be taller.
Oh.
Which is said by Mark Griffin.
Yeah, yeah.
That's his actual voice saying that. I think that might have even been recorded on the day. It might not have. He might have done it into his phone and sent it to us. I don't know. But that one we didn't do his ADR. That was
Hong Kong style.
Hong Kong style, yeah.
Okay. You know what? You've talked about some issues you've had on the film. And every film, we know, has problems. Every film has stumbling blocks along the way. But can you talk about some of the other problems you might have had in shooting this?
Some of the other problems. There was a language problem, obviously. In Hong Kong, it's not so bad. But there was actually some of it. I think was shot on the mainland in China. I can't remember what, but I believe there was something shot there. But they're basically... What was happening with some of the stuff is that our interpreters would take what we had said and change it.
Oh.
So, for example, the roof scene I mentioned earlier,
yeah,
I had said we need 5 hours to shoot this. I think it was something like 9 p.m. till 2 a.m. is what I wanted.
Right.
And when that was translated, it became, we just need onto the roof for a couple of hours. So they knocked 3 hours off in the translation, as it were. So that was a bit of an issue we kind of had to deal with later. Casting was difficult, again, simply because we didn't know that many people on the ground. We knew who we knew. I don't know if I would call it problems. I can't think of anything.
Well, listen, you've described quite a few of them already, so I can understand. But listen, you've been putting this in festivals for how long?
Maybe since the start of 2018, somewhere around. I don't remember.
Whenever
we finished the sound mix.
Are there plans to release this to the public at some point?
I'd imagine it'll go onto YouTube or something as soon as we finish the last festival, which can't be that far away. We're in four festivals this weekend, and I think we've got three coming up.
Wow.
And maybe there's a few after that.
Wow.
To be honest, I don't really monitor the festivals. We've got a friend of ours, Tony Greengrass, has come on as an associate producer afterwards, and he deals just with festival submissions and stuff. It's just such a huge job that someone needed to be dedicated to.
Well, and it's a financial commitment too.
Oh yeah, it's really not easy, and it is very expensive.
It can get very expensive, you know.
Yeah.
Like especially if you're late to a festival, they jack the price up so high.
Yeah.
So the reason I ask is I want people to see this film. It's just so good. It really is such a great film. You did such a wonderful job. Seriously.
Can I give you a festival hack?
Yeah, please do.
For your listeners.
Yeah.
I've put other films into film festivals. Dead End's been much more successful because Brian and Tony really put together a really sensible kind of attack strategy. But one of the things that's come up is if you want to try and make your life easier, find a film that's similar to your own film in tone, perhaps, or in length, and look at what festivals it entered and what it got success from and where it won, and use that as a starting point for what festivals you should apply for.
Wow. That
because
makes
there's
sense.
Millions of them, and every day there's a new one coming out.
Yeah,
and you can get lost. You can pour your money away.
Yeah.
and get nothing from it. Yeah, so that's just true. A kind of festival hack.
Well, I like that.
To save you some money and a lot of time, probably.
Oh, thank you very much. That's a all great right. piece of advice. Is there going to be another film in the series? Is there going to be another Dead
film? There is actually.
Really?
Excellent. We're going back out in December. Although I don't think I've made that official yet. We just have. Brian's announced it. We're going back out in December, and we're going to shoot what Brian is calling Dead End 2. Whether it's directly connected to Dead End 1 or not, right. we're not sure. But we want to go back out and, with the experience of the last one, make something else that's shown maybe the same characters but in different situations. We're probably going to do some fighty stuff in it. We want to show some other areas of Hong Kong as well, because we showed, you know, a few sides of it, but there's just so much more to it. It's such a rich background to play on. It's almost like an art department has been there first. Oh, you know, wow. You go into one of these back alleys, and with no lighting and no art department, you point a camera at it and it looks like someone spent 2 weeks designing it.
Well, you have to go then.
Yeah.
You have to do it.
So we're going to attempt something similar but different.
Well, good. Well, now, what advice would you give to new filmmakers? Because it sounds like you obviously have a ton of experience. So what could you... You know, what advice could you give to new filmmakers?
Can I quote from Diane Bell? Has just released a book called "Shoot from the Heart."
Go right ahead. That's
the advice. Shoot from the heart. She's got it in the title of her book. It's shoot what you want. Don't shoot someone else's film. I mean, you can learn from shooting a film which is based on something else, perhaps, but try and find what's in you and get that onto the screen. That the films that I think win awards, for example, or get recognized or pull an audience in are films that show something unique and different and interesting. And I think if you can shoot from the heart, as she says, and make it your vision on the screen, then that's going to be interesting.
Wow. Does
that make any sense?
That's a fantastic piece of advice. Oh man, that's a fantastic.
Diane Bell's written a book about this, which I've not read, by the way, because it's available on Amazon UK, but it's only available in 2 months from now.
Man, wow!
But the title, she's a Scottish filmmaker, incidentally. I think she's based out of LA now.
Well, you know what? I'll have to give her a call.
You should do.
I will. Okay, one of my favorite podcasts is your podcast, Film Pro Productivity. And the reason it is for me is because I am the most disorganized person alive. And I love it because it really does help me. So can you talk a bit about your podcast, please?
Absolutely. And that's how we connected, of course.
Yeah.
Because I had found another awesome podcast, which is this one you're interviewing me on.
Well, thank you very much.
No problem. But Film Pro Productivity came about because I kind of spent 18 years working and not taking holidays and not taking breaks. And maybe along the way, I spent my time on the wrong things. And actually, post my feature film, I kind of had what is known as a breakdown, which is that I stressed and worried too much over that film. And eventually that kind of affected my mental health and kind of, that wasn't so good. And it's taken me a few years to recover from that and kind of start shooting again. And I, somewhere along the way, became a bit of a productivity junkie. And productivity is big in, you know, the lifestyle worlds and the business worlds, but it doesn't seem to have made much of an influence on the filmmaking world. I did look around for other podcasts that covered similar things. Now, although general filmmaking podcasts do delve into this, it didn't seem to me that I could find one that specifically did it. So I jumped in with both feet and decided to do a seasonal podcast, in the sense that it's going to be released in 12 episode seasons. I'm in the middle of season one at the moment, and it's aimed squarely at filmmakers to make their life easier, to get more done, to get more out of life, I suppose. It's not so much about getting more work done. It's maybe about getting more time off, or more time off from other stuff, which will allow you to focus on the filmmaking, perhaps.
Well, it's helped me tremendously. So I need people to know. You've got to check out Film Pro Productivity, Carter's podcast. And even if you're not in the film industry, it'll give you a hand on your everyday life. It really will.
Yeah. Well, season one is kind of aimed at that sort of. It's quite general, so you know.
It is.
Episode one really talks about higher level thinking, which is getting your mind into the place where you can think strategically about getting stuff done, you know. And the reason I do episode two is about saying no, and the reason I do episode two on that subject is, unless you start saying no to the wrong things, you're never really going to get a foothold and be able to move forward in what you're trying to do. It's you've got to say no to the good to say yes to the great. I think is, I can't remember whose quote I'm using, but mm-hmm. you know, that's kind of point.
Well, this is the kind of stuff you're going to learn, people, from such a great podcast. It really is. So I hope people. I'll put it in the show notes as well for people to link to.
Awesome.
So now we're down to the big three. My last three questions I ask everybody. So what is the biggest filmmaking mistake you ever made, and how did you overcome it? Think about the biggest filmmaking mistake you ever made. Maybe that helps.
Yeah. I mean, I knew this question was coming because I've listened to the show. And yeah, I've made a lot of mistakes. I think the biggest mistake along the way is working with the wrong people.
Yeah.
For example, on my feature, I worked with a good producer, but she was a good television producer. She worked for the BBC. And what I discovered along the way was that, or realised along the way, is that the BBC has got a department that deals with finance and a department that deals with contracts. So after the feature completed, which I was director and I was exec producer on, but after that completed, we had a mess in the contracts department. I had to reissue 2/3 of the contracts, and all in, including extras releases and location agreements and stuff like that. There was 310 contracts. So 2/3 of them, because of problems, which we'd found out when we'd went to review what had come back in, because contracts were going out and not getting signed properly, not getting dated, or not getting witnessed. Somebody had put lines through one of the contracts as well, and these are just little things which, unless you spot them,
right,
they invalidate the contract.
True.
And you can't sell a film unless the contracts are correct. You're not selling, although you are selling a physical copy of the film, a DCP, for example, or you know, a digital print of the film.
Right.
That's only owned by you if you've got a CD or a DVD with all of the contracts on it, or it was a DVD at that time. It's probably just an online kind of link now. So you've got to have scanned every contract, and that proves that you have ownership over every element of the film.
Yeah.
And basically, they were untidy.
Oh, man.
To say the least.
Well, and so, that, no wonder that was a headache for you. Oh.
Yeah, I mean, they say hire slow, fire fast. And yeah. I don't like to use that in this particular instance, because I know these people and they're my friends and things like that, but I think that was just a bad call, and we didn't see it coming because we were inexperienced. And so that was quite a big mistake, though, because the work that had to get done after we completed the shoot was absolutely monumental.
Yeah. And it's not what you expected at all.
No. See, if one person had decided not to sign a contract for it, if let's say they had a bad day on set, and we tried to ensure that everyone had a good time on the show, and they were paid and stuff as well, but if someone decided to be difficult or had fallen out with us, they could have caused a great deal of bother.
Yeah.
So that I mean I've made plenty of mistakes, but that's a biggest. Big one.
Wow. Get the right people. Well, I've made similar mistakes. So working with the right people is just, and go with your gut and all, just, wow. I'm sorry that happened to you. What is the best filmmaking advice you ever received?
we've kind of touched on it in this podcast, and you've mentioned it in other ones, and it's shoot with what you've got.
Yeah.
It's I don't know about you, but I've got kit envy, tech envy. I'm always looking at the next thing. I want it. I don't know why I want it.
You know what, though? I think a lot of people do. I I do, and it's I look at the ginormous, the unreachable, but then I look at the stuff that I can have, and I wonder, should I spend the money on it? Oh yeah, yeah, kid envy for sure.
Yeah, so shoot with what you've got. I've heard it on this podcast say before, but it is true.
Well, when your film comes out, Dead End, people should watch it because they'll learn, shoot with what you've got and look at what you can achieve. Your film is sensational. It's just so good. So that's a great piece of advice. Now, you're not getting off easy. There's still a third one. Uh-oh. Name a film that inspired you.
Well, I'm going to mention my favorite film, and it's not one that many people probably say. It's Kelly's Heroes.
Really?
It's Kelly's Heroes, my favorite film.
Yeah, but that's a great film.
I love that film. It's. I don't think it won any awards or anything like that. But Clint Eastwood, Telly Savalas.
If it talks to you, right?
Don Rickles. Yeah, it's a great movie. It inspires me.
You know what? You can't change what inspires you.
Yep.
So good for you.
That's the one.
Okay, so where can find? Not enough sleep. Where can people find out about you and what you're up to?
You can. My website for fights is fightdirector.com, okay. Which I don't update all the time because I'm not allowed to talk about most of the stuff that I'm working on non-disclosure agreements. But there's plenty of information in there.
Sure.
You can find out about the podcast on filmproproductivity.com. And I'm on Twitter at @fight_director as my personal account. And the podcast's Twitter account is at @filmproprodpod.
Yeah, prodpod. I love that. Yeah, that's great. Well, you know what? I can't believe our conversation is over. I wish we could go on longer because you're just a fascinating guy and you're uber talented. And I can't thank you enough for being here, Carter. I really can't.
Well, thanks for inviting me on. There's to be invited onto a podcast that I was actually listening to. It was fantastic.
Well, I'm glad you're listening, and I hope people listen to this because they've got a lot to learn from you. Thanks again for being here.
Cheers, Ian.
What a show. I just have to thank Carter again for dropping by. I loved our conversation. It was fun. It was informative. And I really hope that he can drop by again and talk about his future projects. As always, if you have any comments or questions about the show, please drop me a line by email at howtheydiditpodcast@gmail.com or stop by my Facebook page at @howtheydiditpodcast. I'm on Twitter at @hfilmmaking and on Instagram at @howtheydiditfilmmaking. Please show your support for the show by subscribing on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Thanks again for joining me, and I'll be back with another show next week. Until then, keep shooting.